Good morning and welcome to Step Into the Light. We're your hosts. I'm Patty Sheen.
And I'm Jean Alfieri. Thank you for listening.
Together, we will introduce you to people who have found their way out of the dark shadows of life and back to light.
And those who, through various ministries and creative endeavors, lead others on their journey from darkness to light. Author Brian Cantor rewrites history so readers can experience it in a whole new way. From the raw materials of dry educational texts, tedious research in primary sources, and grueling archaeological digs, he brings the people, places, and events of the past to life, all mixed together with characters and situations from out of imagination. Create new worlds that we can explore together with his readers. A retired Army officer, he journeys a full time in a motorhome, visiting historic sites and places of extraordinary beauty. Welcome to our show, Brian.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I tell you, I was looking through some of the folks that you have interviewed over your past shows, and I feel very privileged to be counted among that company of incredible personalities.
Well, thank
Brian,
you.
We are very excited to have you here tonight. I've chatted briefly with you a time or two up at our Colorado Springs meetings, and I believe I was there when you did a presentation at one of our meetings, and we're just really delighted to have you here on the show today. So thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. After Dean's introduction, my goodness, I'm not sure where to begin with your fascinating background. Let's start with that fantasy life that I think a lot of people would maybe dream about living, including me, of exploring the country in a motorhome. Have you visited every state in the Union? And if not, how far have you roamed?
Well, I've had the vagabond blood in me probably my whole entire life. I grew up in the Park Service. My father was a Park Service naturalist and ranger. And so we moved around quite a bit. I have been to 49 of the 50 states. I still have yet to make it to Maine. However, most of that was before I started in the motorhome. I've only been doing the full timing in the motorhome for a little bit over a year now. And unfortunately, last year was a little bit constrained in terms of how much and how far afield we could go. But I was able to hit Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, California, Washington, Oregon, and a little bit into the Wyoming, Montana area. So it wasn't a bad year last year, and I'm looking forward to, as things open up a little bit, to be able to wander around a bit more.
Brian, of all these different places that you have seen, this may be a hard answer for you. Do you have a favorite place to which you would like to return or maybe even settle down someday?
That is a hard question, really, because I've not only traveled a lot in the U.S., but also internationally, both with the Army and then just, again, because I kind of have the vagabond blood, I do a lot of traveling. I have kind of two categories of places, particularly in the U.S., that I like to see. I love to see places of natural beauty, which many of which tend to be out west. You know, we've kind of, I always tell people that everything in the west is more extreme. We got taller mountains and bigger bodies of water and deeper valleys and all that kind of thing. So I really love the west because of the natural beauty. I love one of my areas focus both for research and writing is colonial American history. And so most of those sites are obviously out on the east coast. So I will end up bouncing back and forth, I think, enjoying a little bit of vacation time and the natural beauty, and then hitting some of the sites out east, you know, for the colonial history. But I will tell you, for I think natural beauty, my absolute total favorite place, perhaps in the entire world, is Yosemite National Park. Just absolutely stunning. I need to go back there again this year. I was there last year, but it was right when the wildfires were hitting California, and most of the time I was there, you couldn't see more than a few hundred yards in any direction. I did get a couple of good days. Now, that's beautiful. Big Sur, the Big Sur coast along California, absolutely fascinating. The sea stacks out at Cape Flattery, Washington, which is kind of the farthest northwest corner of the continental United States. Mount Rainier is a beautiful area. And then for anybody that hasn't been to Alaska, anything that you see down here, even the, you know, the Rocky Mountains are stunning. And a lot of the just the Grand Peaks and things like that that we have down here. But if you go to Alaska, the terrain up there is just phenomenal compared to what we have down here. So the Kenai Fjord area is absolutely stunning. So lots and lots of incredible places that I'd like to visit, both here and then out east. I think for colonial sites, some of my favorite places are the Boston area. There's all kinds of neat things in and around Boston and Plymouth and those areas. And then Williamsburg, if you've never been there, for the reconstructed historical area, is kind of a really unique experience. And then Philadelphia is also, from a colonial history perspective, just I could spend weeks or months there. And so that's the good thing about a motorhome. You can pick up your house, take it with you, and then stay in some of these areas for – you know, 2, 3, 4, 6 months, and really have a chance to experience some of the more detailed things about the area and some of the history and those kinds of things. Do some hiking out west. It's just a really fun lifestyle.
It sounds fantastic, and I have to agree. The East Coast, especially if you like seafood, oh my goodness, the delicious fresh fish of any kind out there. And I actually happen to be in Esalen, which is along the coast of Big Sur, for a writer's class. And I agree with you, Brian. I don't know that I got any writing done because I'm staring off into the ocean. It was just so breathtaking. But, yeah, there's a lot in this country to see, for sure.
And there's some incredible places overseas, too, to visit. I think one of my favorite places overseas, in 2018, I was able to spend 6 months in Scotland. And I was doing research on a book that I'm getting ready to publish on the 4th of June called Daughter of the Gods. But it was research about 4th century Picts, the Pictish people that were there before the Scottish people were there, actually. And but the Highlands and Islands of Scotland, I don't know why it's such an enchanting place. I mean, it's cold and rainy most of the time, but it's just stunning beauty and very enchanting because of the history and, yeah, just the mystique that you have of the Scottish Highlanders and things like that. It was an incredible opportunity to visit for that long.
Patty, I think we should make this a travel episode, Patty. What do you think?
I know. I was thinking that. I wonder if Brian writes any travel books.
There's a thought, Brian. Really, you might want to consider that.
Well, hopefully it's travel through time, so I can include a little bit of both the different places and the locations, and then also bring in the flavor of the different time periods along with that,
sure.
too. So.
Okay, so let's talk about the writing. What does it mean to be a missionary writer, and what are some of the challenges that you face?
Yes, I know there's obviously in the writing community a large portion of the publishing industry that's Christian publishers and Christian literature and things like that. What I've seen, and it's not in every case, but a lot of that is targeted towards encouraging Christian believers, uplifting them, helping disciple Christian believers, and just kind of guiding people in different aspects of their faith. You know, everything from things like Bible studies and things like that to very practical ministry kinds of things and helping people deal with the kinds of issues we deal with. But not a lot of that ends up reaching out in an evangelistic kind of way to the non-Christian audience. I did a master's degree that I finished up, took me a long time to do it, but finished it up in 2011. And my master's thesis for that degree program was on evangelism in a postmodern context, postmodern culture. I won't go too into this too far. Modernism was very much believing before belonging. So, in other words, you convince me of your truth, and then I'll join your group. And of course, the Protestant Christian movement was kind of in parallel, if you will, with the Enlightenment. And so it was all about scientific discovery and questioning things and not just taking the words of the word of authorities, but, you know, that believing before belonging. Well, postmodernism is very opposite to that. It's belonging before believing. And one of the characteristics of postmoderns is that they're more receptive to new ideas, or what Christians might term as truth, in story form rather than in the form of a kind of a logical argument. Not uncommon among postmoderns, if you try to prove something to them and you give them all the facts and they go, well, I'm glad that works for you, but I don't think that'll work for me. So, but they're very receptive to truths or ideas presented in story form. My goal as a, like say, missionary writer is to write to that group of people that is outside of the Christian faith and just try to share ideas with them that might be, that they might just not encounter either in their normal, in the normal culture, or certainly they're not the kind of people that would walk into a church or a Bible study or some other kind of traditional way of encountering the Christian faith. That's the target audience. And really, it's also not – so in my novels, you'll very rarely, if ever, find somebody who is converted. If you look at the continuum of discipleship, if you will, from somebody, say, who's at a negative 10 in their experience with Christianity, which is I hate Christians and everything they stand for, that zero point is kind of that point of conversion, and then positive 10 is somebody who's a committed life missionary. Well, a lot of focus in evangelism is to try to get people to cross that negative one to positive one thing, to make that kind of personal commitment to follow Jesus, right, and to accept him into your life. I'm really focusing on trying to take people maybe from a negative 7 or 8 just up a few stages, maybe to a negative 6 or negative 5, just, you know, where they're a little bit more receptive to some Christian principles and ideas, so that somebody else then can pick up the torch and maybe help walk them a little bit closer to that the positive section on the scale there. So that's kind of what I mean by missionary writing, targeting those audiences that are not going to pick up your normal everyday Christian literature. And so that's kind of where I'm trying to go with that.
That's a neat strategy. And really what you're wanting to do is just make people go, right? Maybe. Let me give this some more thought. And really be thought-provoking.
Yeah, that's exactly the case. And it just exposing them to ideas that they may not encounter in the normal culture that are Christian faith-based ideas.
Sure.
Thank you for sharing that.
Well, I feel like I'm in good company because I look back at the Bible and I see Jesus telling a whole lot of stories. And even, you know, the Old Testament, they're true to life stories, right? So they're not made up fictional stories. But even in the Old Testament, you know, I suppose if what was very important to God was just straight up doctrine, he probably could have given us a systematic theology written in about 100 pages or so and covered most of the stuff we need to know. But he didn't do that, right? He gave us the Bible over 1,500 years, you know, scads of different writers, right? You know, 30, 40 different writers that in many cases communicated in stories and histories and letters and poems and things like that. So I like that sometimes, you know, sometimes with a story, you don't even have to point the lessons out to people, and different people will take different lessons from that same story. And they can all be true lessons, right? But they've just heard different things in the story that connects with them. And so that's what I'm hoping I'll be able to do with my writing.
Yes, well, it sounds like you have a wonderful mission there, Brian, and you're right about those stories in the Bible, and Jesus told them in such a way that they were always relevant to the people he was speaking to at the time. He knew that that those stories would connect with the particular group that he was trying to get his message across to at that particular time. Brian, would you tell us, you in the introduction we talked about how you were an Army officer, so when did you know that you wanted to be a writer, and how difficult was the transition from Army officer to author?
Well, I'll tell you what, I think I probably have loved writing ever since I was a kid. I've got a bunch of, I still have a bunch of stories that I wrote, short stories and things like that that I wrote when I was in high school and things like that. I even remember, and I think I've got a copy of this too, an essay that I wrote in college about how effective stories are at communicating ideas. You know, things that are explained to people, they might intellectually understand, but when you can capture that same idea in a story, then it just really kind of resonates with people's emotions and their feelings, and they can connect with it in a way that goes beyond just an intellectual understanding or assent. And so I think that was in the back of my mind the whole time. I didn't write a whole lot. I wrote more technical stuff when I was in the military. But really that college course, when I did my thesis and I kind of understood that idea about postmoderns and how they resonate with stories a little bit better than they resonate with logical arguments, I think that was kind of an aha moment for me. And I really think that the Lord was preparing me up until that point to come to that understanding and then to accept that calling. So it was a good timing because I was just about ready to retire from the military when I finished up my coursework, just almost exactly at the same time. And I did a little bit of defense contracting work in between there, but had an opportunity to step away from that and to focus more on writing at that point. So it was a very natural transition point, but I think the key thing was that I really just felt like God was saying, this is how I can use you as part of my big plan. And just a little tiny thread in the big tapestry, but it's something that I really felt God was calling me to.
And don't you love when you get to a place that you can actually recognize that and go, oh, well, here's what he was doing, and it started 10, 20, 30 years ago. It's so neat.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I'll tell you what, too, some of my best experiences with God are in the writing process, right? So a lot of times I'll have the story in my head, I've made it to a certain point, and I like to go out for prayer walks, you know, for an hour or so during the day if I have a chance to, and I'll be just talking with God about different things, but a lot of times the writing and the stories will come up, and I can't tell you how many times God has put ideas into my head. I'll go back and write them down and incorporate them into the story, and then 3 or 4 weeks later I'll come back as I'm reviewing or editing that section and go, where did that come from? I didn't come up with that.
Mm-hmm.
And wow. So I really strongly feel like God is using me and inspiring me. Sometimes we talk about the incarnation of Jesus, and I think that that's a form of incarnation where God is in you expressing ideas through you, and that you're doing that together with him. And I just, that's an amazing experience for me of closeness to God, I think.
Yeah, a partnership.
Yes, definitely. Like Alan Arnold talks about when he talks about creating with God and not just for God.
Yeah.
You were talking about creating with God, and that's one of the things that God, you know, God is a creator. He created us in his image, and I think image is putting within us a creative spirit to be like our Heavenly Father.
Yes. So, Brian, tell us a bit about these archaeological digs. Now, these are digs that you've actually done. Is that correct?
Yeah. So my first one was I was in my religious studies curriculum that I took, I had an opportunity. It was an elective course, but to go over to Israel for six weeks in the summer, and it was in 2011. And that first dig was at a site in Israel called Kirbet Kiefa, It's very likely the biblical city. If you look it up in the Bible, you can find it. There's a few different references to it called Sha'araim. And that name literally means two gates. Sha'araim means two gates. And if you look at almost all of the Iron Age cities in Israel, many of which were fortified, if they were fortified, they almost all just had one gate. At the time, Jerusalem or the city of David, one gate. The city of Lachish, big fortified city, one gate. But this thing had two gates, and it sat right on the border of Israel and the Philistine territory. And so it actually is right on the ridge line overlooking the valley of Elah, which is where David fought Goliath. And so the Israelites were all lined up along this ridge line around this fortified city of Sha'araim. And then the Philistines were across the valley on the other ridge line, and David fights Goliath in that valley. So that was just an amazing site to dig at. It was a lot of fun, but a lot of really interesting history around the area and things like that too. So fantastic way to really dig into history, literally.
Did you uncover anything? And was that research for a specific book?
Yeah, so and everybody always wants to find something really cool. I'll tell you what we did find was thousands of potsherds, broken pieces of pottery and things like that. It turns out that those are some of the most valuable things that you can find, particularly if you can find what they call diagnostic pieces, which are things with rims or handles or something like that, because pottery is one of the things that they primarily use in archaeology to confirm dating and things like that. So pottery styles tend to be very characteristic of a period, a people, and a time and things. So we found thousands of potsherds. We found olive pits that they could use to carbon date and things like that. Found some animal bones and things like that, again, that were useful for doing not only carbon dating, but also telling what kinds of, interestingly, at these sites in the different layers. During the Israelite occupation of those, you didn't find a lot of pig bones. During the Philistine occupations of those areas, you'd find more pig bones because the Israelites wouldn't eat pigs. So those kinds of things. But my fun thing I found when I was there at Sha'araim that summer was a ballista, and it's just a rounded off piece of rock that was about the size of a softball or so, but it was a sling stone. It was literally something that they would put into a sling and throw, bigger than something you'd pick up out of a stream, so probably bigger than something like David might have thrown at Goliath, but it definitely identified that fortification as more than just, a rural village that happened to have a wall around it. This is a fortified thing that really was set up with some kind of military purpose, because those were larger military grade ballista stones. And I found one of those, and I was so excited to hold it. A lot of the things that you really find are the architectural features. You're finding building structures and rooms and walls and stuff like that. So people get really excited when they find an Egyptian scarab or a coin or something like that, because those are very useful for dating things. Plus, they're also things that we can kind of recognize as value. I didn't find any of those, but lots of people did that were at the site the same time I was there.
How neat.
And there isn't a one of us that hasn't been exposed to the educational system throughout our lifetime that has had to deal with reading those usually very thick, sometimes boring history textbooks. So tell us, what is your technique for turning those dry educational texts into something that readers will actually want to pick up and be able to enjoy and learn from? How do you make it exciting?
Yeah, and I think, and as writers, as fellow writers, I think you all would recognize this as well. that it's the story. So you can pick up those textbooks, and they're fantastic for setting a little bit of the context. You know, what was happening in the bigger world at the time. And then you can, but what I really like to dig into is not what were the big movements, what were the wars that were going on, what were the political machinations of the time, what were, you know, some of the maybe religious squabbles that people were going through and things like that. That's really neat for setting the context, but I love to dig into the everyday lives of lives. How did they live? And it's really, as you're writing along, I have so many times I've done this. I'd be writing along, and I'd have to stop because I'd go, well, what would they be wearing? What would it have been made out of? What would they be eating? If they were going to do some, you know, if they got ill, how would they have tried to treat that? Silly things like, I've so many times been wanting to go, and she gaped with her mouth open for several seconds or for a minute or something like that. And then I go, oh, shoot, they didn't have seconds and minutes back then. You know, how would I say this? Or, you know, he ran, you know, he threw a stone 30 yards. Didn't have yards. I can't necessarily use that in this particular context. So, you know, how would they have thought of those kinds of things, and how would they express those things? And so it becomes really fun to dig into the personal lives. And I think that's where we can connect people with history in the stories, right? They don't want to connect with the big events of the day. They want to connect with somebody who was maybe an ordinary person living through extraordinary circumstances. And, you know, what did they think? What did they feel? How did they react? How did they interact with other people? Sometimes maybe even how did they interact with incredibly famous people? And so to me, that's the exciting part, and the part that takes a lot of digging and sleuthing and things like that. That's why I spent 6 months in Scotland researching the Picts and finding out what did they, and just walking the ground. I literally walked all over. I probably spent, of the 6 months I was there, I probably spent at least an entire month just walking the ground that my characters would be walking as in the story that I was writing. So just amazing insights that you can get into, you know, put yourself in the shoes of somebody who lived at that time and try to experience the land from their perspective. A lot of fun.
It sounds like a lot of fun. And you've got just a bunch of activities. When we look at the scope of all that you cover to write a story, Brian, travel, you've got research, you've got, you know, looking at what happened in the past and making it come to life now, literally walking, hiking, exploring. What part would you say you like the most?
Ooh, that's tough. it's not really that tough. I'll tell you the process that I go through is I try to read about the places and the time periods first, so that it gives me a little bit of a reference, because in many cases it's hard to transpose yourself back into a different time, even if you're at the place. But once you've got that in your mind and you've kind of adopted that little bit of a framework and a thought process, then I love, my favorite part of all is to go out and experience it. I did this when I went to Greece. And as an example, the Apostle Paul on Mars Hill. And so literally going to that spot, that exact spot, looking up at the Acropolis in Athens, and seeing at least bits and pieces of what he would have seen from there, and just thinking of the, you know, the things that he said and the little dialogue that he got into with the Athenian philosophers at the time. So I did the reading beforehand and the research and, you know, read the travel logs and, you know, some of the tourist information and things like that, and then go out and walk it and see it and experience it and imagine yourself in the shoes of those people or your characters or whatever it is. That it did that in Israel too. That was I'll tell you one of the things about amazing things about visiting Israel. We read about those things in the Bible, mm-hmm. but when you can go and literally, you know, we got on a boat that was a reconstruction of the kind of fishing boat that the apostles might have been in back then, Peter and James and John, and floated around in that boat on the Sea of Galilee. And I'll tell you what, if that doesn't make the Bible just come alive to you, we know that it's true, but, you know, sometimes in the back of your mind you're thinking that this is just so distant from us in terms of, you know, cultural distance and time and all that kind of stuff, that it almost doesn't seem real. But when you're standing there looking at the same things that Jesus would have been looking at and feeling the heat and the grit of the sand beneath your feet, it becomes very, very live and very meaningful.
I bet. That sounds wonderful.
That almost makes chills go up my back hearing you describe it.
Right?
To imagine actually being there must be absolutely amazing.
And some of these things, for example, the other site that I dug out in 2017 was at Lachish. And we don't read a whole lot about it in the Bible, but it was a major, major city at the time in Israel. And so the Sennacherib, the Assyrian king, came down and besieged both Lachish first and then Jerusalem. They actually wiped out most of the cities of Judah. Lachish was one of the final ones that he was at. And while they were still there in their siege of Lachish, they sent a group up to warn Jerusalem, hey, you're next. And, you know, so we have the stories that are when that happened and things, right? But the way the Assyrians conquered Lachish was to build a siege ramp up the side of it and just, you know, build a big giant dirt ramp up one side and then use some siege engines to break over the wall and get over the wall and get in and things like that. I'm oversimplifying it. But Sennacherib had a relief carved of that, the conquest of Lachish, and put into the Assyrian capital. The Brits came and found it and took it over to the British Museum in London. And so when I was in the UK, I had a chance to go down there and see that. So I had literally dug where that happened. I saw the siege ramp for myself. We dug up a lot of the bits and pieces of things, you know, that indicated a destruction layer in the city. So we had a lot of evidence of that actual siege. And then to go up and see it documented in a stone relief in these big giant panels, probably, 30, 40, 50 yards worth of these stone panels that are carved in with the story of their conquest of Lachish. So just fantastic. And again, makes the Bible come alive, right? This stuff really happened.
Well, Brian and Dean, we're going to go to a short break here. I'd like to remind listeners that you're listening to Step Into the Light with host Gene Alfieri and Patty Sheen. Today, our guest is author Brian Cantor. Man, Brian has really kept us at the edge of our seat with all of his stories about his travels. He's living a wonderful life. He travels by motorhome all over the country. He shared with us quite a bit about the different things he has seen in his travels, but then he also does a lot of research for his novels, and oh my goodness, he has just shared a lot of information with us about things that he has learned and things that he has seen, and we could probably go on for another 2 hours with that because he's just so fascinating. If you'd like to listen to this podcast again or hopefully refer it to friends and family, go to PattySheen.com. That is my website. That is spelled PattySheen.com. At the top of the page, you will find a Blog Talk Radio tab. Click on that, and you will find a link to each and every one of the podcasts that we have aired to date. Under each podcast listing is also a More Information tab, and that's where you will find the links to our guest social media websites, things of that nature. Also, this particular show will be available, I believe, right on the homepage under pattysheen.com for about 3 or 4 weeks. So it's fairly easy to get to, and we hope that you will share this podcast with other folks. So, Brian, as you may know, the premise of this show, we talk about people who have talked to people who have found their way out of a dark time in their life and how they made their way back to light. Would you share with us perhaps a time when things weren't going quite as well as you had hoped, and it just seemed kind of like a depressing time, or just not as bright as you'd like it to have been? And how did you find your way back to light during that period of time?
Yeah, well, as I'm sure many of your listeners have experienced in their own lives, and perhaps you as well. The things that are most important in this world are not necessarily the things you accomplish, or certainly not the stuff that you acquire, but it's your relationships. And I had the incredible just blessing of growing up in a very stable family. My parents were married for 60 years before they passed away. So, and they were, you know, always very good to us, very loving, very kind. I always tell my friends I grew up in Leave It to Beaver land, and have just been amazed at, you know, some of the things that would happen in other families. But unfortunately, that I was not able to walk in their footsteps. I got married when I was about 27 years old, and was married for 12 years. And at the end of that time, my then wife asked for a divorce. And I know that happens to a lot of people, and statistically, you know, about half of the marriages don't work out, and it doesn't seem like it's that big of a deal in our country anymore. But if you've ever been through that, you realize it really is a big deal. And particularly when you've been that close with someone and shared in their lives, you know, that closely for that long, it can just be very personally devastating. I especially felt like a failure, because I think I was one of the first people, certainly the only person in my immediate family to ever get a divorce. The only one, you know, my aunts and uncles. I have an aunt and uncle who are my godparents in Ohio that I think just celebrated their, I don't know, 65th anniversary or something like that. Just, you know, very stable kinds of relationships, and here, my relationship was a failure. You know, my most important relationship in terms of relationship with people was a failure. And so that was very difficult, particularly because we were Christian, right? And
yes.
So we were supposed to have had better, you know, better motivations for being in a marriage. Supposed to be the kind of people that would extend mercy and grace to each other. And so anyway, that felt like a big failure. In the middle of that, while I was separated pending divorce from my ex-wife, I ended up getting deployed to Iraq for 15 months. And so, you know, while I was in my time in the desert, spent a lot of time just kind of praying through that. And I wasn't there. I couldn't do anything to try to help fix my marriage or save my marriage. Was just kind of separated from it all. And so I think that was probably one of the most difficult, darkest times, at least in my personal experience.
Absolutely, Brian. Yeah, it sure sounds like it. And, you know, I mentioned this at the very beginning of the show, and I apologize that I didn't. But I wanted to thank you for your service to our country. I take it to heart very, very strongly that people have served in the armed forces. I have a sister and brother-in-law that were in the Air Force for 20 years, and my husband was in the Air Force and was in Vietnam, and I'm involved in our Veterans of Foreign Wars organization auxiliary here in town. And so I meant to express that to you at the very beginning of the show, Brian. Thank you so much for your service.
Well, thank you for saying that. I really appreciate it. And I recognize that military service can also be very difficult for families and family members. And so when you talk about your relatives that have served, I understand that there's a sacrifice on both sides of that, not just the people who are in the military or that are going, but also the families that are left behind for that period of time, or just, who are drug all over, literally all over the country or all over the world every 2 or 3 years is in changing assignments, and difficult sometimes for families to put down any kind of roots and establish some kind of stability. So thank you both for your sentiments and your service to those who serve.
So, Brian, when you talk about having to be away during this time and how difficult it was, right, not to even be able to deal with it in person, but have to be removed from it, what was the turning point for you to being okay with that? Because at some point, right, it has to resolve. And was it a matter of time? Was it any particular event that transpired that let you know you were going to be okay? Was there a turning point for you?
Yeah, and I'll tell you, I can't point to a Saul of Tarsus experience where all of a sudden, wham, it hits me and, everything changes. I'm thankful for those people who do have those kinds of experiences. For me, it was just kind of a long slug out. By slug out, I mean just kind of pushing through it. But with the Lord, I mean, you go through this sequence in prayer of, Lord, why is this happening? Why did you allow this to happen? And all those kinds of things. And what could I have done differently? And to a certain extent, I think many people do find, and I'm not a psychologist, so I don't know what I'm talking about in terms of being a psychologist or a counselor or something like that. But it seems like a lot of times people place, and maybe I was doing this, placing our personal value in or driving our personal value from other people. And I remember very distinctly as I was praying many of those times, one of the things that I just heard God say to me over and over and over again was, find your sufficiency in me, right? What matters is most is our relationship. The value that you have is incredible value. The value that you have as a person, as my child, is that I was willing to sacrifice my one and only son on your behalf. Jesus says, I was willing to sacrifice my own life for you to reconcile you back to him and the Father, right? And so I think that was very helpful to just find, again, find my sufficiency in him, that I don't have to have a marriage relationship to have personal value. And I don't know, hopefully that also helps later on enter into more healthy relationships with people down the line, right? Because there's not that little bit of codependency that's happening and things like that. You're able to give into a relationship from a position of, again, I'm sufficient in Christ. That's enough, and then I have something to share in a relationship. So that was very helpful to me. It's kind of ironic. When I came back, I ended up coming back to Colorado Springs from Iraq. So I left from Virginia, went to Iraq, came back to Colorado Springs. And ended up, and I know my ex did not do this intentionally, but I got the final divorce decree in the mail on my birthday.
wow.
So that was not the best birthday present you could really want. But anyway, I think by that time, I had been more settled in my mind, not only that, yes, this was going to happen. There's nothing that I could do to save it. A relationship requires two people, not just one. And you can't just decide to have a good one. You have to have one with the other person. But also I had, by that time, I think I had started to get God's message to find my sufficiency in him.
And that is a beautiful message, Brian. So thank you for sharing that. I believe there's someone that needs to hear that. Sometimes there isn't that pivotal moment. It is slugging it through. And to hear that someone has been successful slugging it through and opening their heart, because it's a very difficult time to open your heart to, I imagine. Thank you for sharing that.
Yes, most definitely, Brian. Thank you so much for sharing it and what you have learned from it and what God has taught you. So, yes, definitely. Thank you so much.
So, Brian, tell us about your books, right? We've gotten this far with all of this background. What is available now, and what do you have in the works?
Yeah, my first book, actually, and it's funny, again, this was not – it wasn't really intentionally going to be a book, and it doesn't fit my mold of trying to write for non-Christian audiences. One of the things that I had done when I kind of understood this characteristic of postmoderns was to write some narrative sermons. So I have had the chance to speak a little bit, but one of my favorite ones, this story actually started coming into my mind in Iraq. I had the chance to start a worship group over in Balad Air Base, and I remember when this idea started to brew in my mind, but it was just looking at Mary Magdalene and her encounters with Jesus. And so I built a little narrative story sermon about that, where I pulled the pieces from the Bible where we have Mary in there. Now, I did something that the 4th century church did, which was merge Mary Magdalene and Mary of Bethany into one person. And there's debates. I think most modern scholars would probably say they're not the same person, depending on who you talk to. But there's certainly a good possibility that they could have been the same person. But I wrote this sermon from that perspective, and people really enjoyed that and connected with it. And another time I wrote another narrative sermon from the perspective of Martha, so Mary and Martha of Bethany. And then, of course, Lazarus was their brother, and so I sat down at a different time and wrote what was originally intended to be a sermon from Lazarus' perspective, but it ended up being a little bit too long, so it was more of a short story. But it was interesting just to see, and again, as I was writing these things, I was experiencing a relationship with Jesus from different perspectives, completely, totally different perspectives. And even though in many cases the circumstances were the same, right? They all experienced Lazarus' death, burial, and resurrection. They obviously experienced it from very different points of view. So it was really neat to kind of learn the characters a little bit differently that way, and a little bit more deeply. And then at the church I was at, somebody knew that I had written these stories and had heard a couple of the sermons, and said, well, what about Simon the leper, Simon the Pharisee? If you put the two Marys together, you have to put the two Simons together. So I ended up writing one from him, from his perspective, and that ended up coming together as a collection, kind of a four-part book called The Bethany Tales. It's, again, these stories from each one of their perspectives. I had to rewrite those stories because something that you can do in an hour in a sermon, or 45 minutes in a sermon, it's just different. It's kind of a different medium and things like that. So I ended up rewriting those stories, but then collected those together. It's called The Bethany Tales. I published that last February, and I just really enjoyed writing that and learning, you know, all about the time period and the characters and all of that kind of stuff. And I was able to pull in some of the insights that I had gained from archaeological digs and being in Israel. And so that was a lot of fun. And it was my first foray into both publishing and writing. And so just had a ball with that. From my perspective, it's done pretty well. It's not it's not going to be on the New York Times bestseller list, but certainly the people that have read it and have provided feedback to me have really enjoyed it and found it to be inspiring and that kind of thing. So that's out there. But again, that's very intentionally Christian. It's historical fiction, but biblical fiction and very intentionally Christian. The book that I am going to publish, it's going to be released on the 4th of June this year, so just in a few weeks now, is called Daughter of the Gods. It's set in 4th century Scotland. And again, that's one of those places where the history books give you the time period and kind of the essence of it. The timing was 367 AD. There was what they called the Barbarian Conspiracy. And it was the Celtic tribes, both in Scotland and Ireland, generally were not united. They were known more for fighting among themselves than they were for uniting. They all came together to try to drive the Romans out of what we would call England. The big giant wall that the Romans built across the England called Hadrian's Wall. Emperor Hadrian had it commissioned, and it was basically you stay north up there and you leave us alone. But anyway, that was the context. They were going to get together to raid this wall and try to drive the Romans out of Britain. And so that's the big event context. But the story is really about a 17-year-old healer's apprentice, a Pict girl, who finds herself embroiled between gods and men, if you will. The Druids had a huge influence in the culture, in the Celtic culture that was what pervaded up there in the north, in the highlands, in the island, in Scotland. And they believed that in order to win the battle on the ground, win the military battle, that they first had to overcome the Roman god. And at the time, the Roman god, now this is after Constantine and the Edict of Milan, was, at least the aristocracy in Rome, was Christian. And so you have the pagans arrayed against the Christians. And they convince this young healer girl that she's going to have this key role in winning the battle against the Roman god so that their military campaign on the ground can succeed. It was a lot of fun to do the research and the writing. It's kind of an epic length historical fiction, borderline historical fantasy, because we get so much of the Celtic mythology in there. But that context allowed me to set up the comparison between the pagan religions and the pagan gods, the Celtic gods, and the Christian God, and what they're about and what they're like. Big long book, you know, almost 500 pages long book. But there's only about three scenes in there that are explicitly Christian scenes. So my hope is that in that, again, I'm going to be able to accomplish that goal of being able to just give people some glimpses into what's this Christian faith like, particularly as it's compared and contrasted against the Celtic pagan faith that you see throughout the whole rest of the book.
That and was what a compelling storyline. That is so interesting.
Yes, it sure sounds like it. I know that you've got all these things on your plate, and in addition to that, you have added the starting of a publishing company. Can you tell us in just a couple of minutes' time what prompted that and what is your goal for your publishing company?
Yeah, it's really simple. And the thing is to be able to provide a venue for missionary writers. I had a good friend up in Denver who published a book several years ago. It was the teen novel of the year. It's called After. One of my classmates from West Point, and I read that book, and I immediately sent her an email, and I said, Amy, what an amazing Christian book you've written. And she said, shh, don't tell my editor or my publisher, because they never would have let me publish it if they had known that it was Christian. So she did that. She portrayed these Christian values in her book and principles, but not in an overt way. And what I discovered when I was looking at publishing companies was that you either have the general audience publishing companies or the Christian publishing companies. And if you publish with a Christian publisher, non-Christians in many cases are just not going to read it.
Right.
And so if you publish with a general audience publisher and it's too overtly Christian, then they'll tell you to go find a Christian publisher. You know, this is a Christian book, go find a Christian publisher. So what my publishing company is to recruit and also to mentor people. So this is, it's going to be I call it an unhybrid, because I'm going to provide the funding.
Like
so it's similar to a traditional publisher in the fact that I'm going to provide the funding. But the goal is really to, as an incubator for others who want to be missionary writers, who want to write for the general audience, but reflect some Christian principles and values in their writing. And so I can not only help them publish their book, but then also help teach them about the self-publishing world. It is technically a traditional publisher, again, because it's a company, official company. I provide all the funding. The company provides all the funding. Authors won't have to pony up, you know, $20,000 or whatever to get their book published. I'd pay for that, split the royalties well until the costs are covered, and then help them learn the self-publishing process so that then they be able to replicate that for themselves later on. So that's the goal.
Very good. Well, thanks for sharing that with us, Brian. And I wanted to thank you so much for spending time with us tonight, Brian, and for sharing as much of your life and your experiences and your goals as you did.
Well, thank you very much. To me, again, it's an honor and a privilege to be able to have this conversation with you all. And I look forward to, now that I've discovered your channel, to go back and to listen to. I just saw a number of people in there. I was like, oh, I've got to listen to that interview. I've got to listen to that interview. So I look forward to doing that.
Thank you, Brian. It was such a pleasure.
Listeners, in closing, we all encounter dark periods in our lives to one degree or another. During those difficult times, strive to seek the light, knowing that when we allow it to shine through, it is so much brighter than we remembered. Don't forget to go to HattieSheen.com. There you can check out all of our podcasts and hopefully refer this one and all the ones that you enjoy to your friends, to your family. You will find links to Brian's social media on there, as well as to all of our other guests. Thanks for being with us today. Look forward to having you with us again next week. God bless.
There is a candle in every soul, some brightly burning, some dark and cold. There is a spirit who brings a fire, ignites a